Committee on Health Care to order. In business. And let's go in order. Or let's, before we... I guess we can't do it without opening. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 117A, Senate Bill 132, Senate Bill 159A, and ask Senator Montes Anderson to come and help us.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Trout, Deadwood Village, and Fairview, and I'm delighted to be here to talk with you. Let's start with House Bill 117, exempts dental clinics. This has been a very contentious issue for several years.
Is that Senate Bill 117?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 117.
Senate, thank you.
Yeah, 117. This has been a very contentious issue, and one that I have felt strongly that Oregon is the only state that requires dental clinics to have an owner, a dentist be an owner of whatever clinic entity. Well, it seems like each session almost there's someone that's coming before us to exempt themselves out of it. And we keep exempting everyone out except organizations like the MCOs, like Willamette Dental. And so I have committed to work in the interim with the Dental Association, the Medical Board of Dentistry, and interested stakeholders to work on this very issue. And I hear there may be a possible amendment to actually do that this time. This has been an issue that came before us a few years ago, and I feel the climate is such that I believe that the dentists are willing to come forward. But the bill as is, we worked on it and we did discuss the very issues that I think you will be discussing today. And I would recommend that you pass it in current form with the intention that we definitely have to address this issue that makes Oregon very unique and I think is detrimental to dentistry in the state of Oregon. With that, I will conclude my testimony on Senate Bill 177, and I do also would like to talk about Senate Bill 159. And I didn't realize this was up before you, but all I can say is it would be important to pass this bill.
But not the others?
Well, that's up to you. Anyway, that's all I have to say, and thank you very much.
Senator
Montes,
thank you. Any questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Senator?
I think he's going first.
Right. Yes.
The amendment that you referred to is my amendment?
Oh, you have an amendment that addresses taking away the ability.
It repeals that section of the ORS.
I will definitely be in favor of that next time around, yes.
And this, I read the bill. I thought that was strange.
It's very strange.
I went to the ORS and said, well, that's ridiculous.
Ridiculous, absolutely.
I went and created an amendment, not knowing that other people felt this way.
Absolutely.
And so...
It feels strange not to be the only one, huh?
Let's jointly sponsor that bill next time around.
I will have to say, I've had a conversation with the ODA, and I've had a conversation with Portland State, and my intent is not to kill 117. And I know that this amendment would generate substantial upheaval, and so my intent is not to kill the bill because we're trying to fix a problem. And I, as long as we're going to talk about this in the interim, I would be more than supportive of that position. And I know Representative Harker, and I've had several conversations since this morning about it.
Representative Harker, you want to join the discussion? We're going to hear some testimony, too, I'm sure.
Okay. I think we could hear the additional testimony then. Thanks for providing the historical background there.
That's right. It is when I remember when it first came before us, I was really very appalled that we would still be, I feel, have some very draconian ways of conducting business in the state through the Board of Dentistry. But I really want to hear and want to make sure that the dentists are at the table, absolutely, and help us get through this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator. I'll tell you what I'll do. To get orderly, I'll close all three hearings. Close the hearing on 117, close the hearing on 132, close the hearing on 159, and start again. Now that we've had this out of there. Let me open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 117A. We have some folks wanting to talk to us. We have Jesse Cornett, Patrick Bratz, and Steve Petroselli. I think, Margie, are you going to talk to us? Okay. When these fine gentlemen are, I wouldn't want to have you get in the middle of that lineup. Let's see. Who's first? Jesse, talk to us, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jesse Cornett, and I'm the Government Relations Director for Portland State University, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 117. It's a pleasure to be here in front of you today. Senate Bill 17 was introduced at the request of the Oregon University System and is critical for retaining basic dental care for Portland State and University of Oregon students. I'm going to speak really about PSU's clinic since that's the one that I'm familiar with, but U of O has a strong interest in seeing this legislation pass as well. Our dental clinic was a result of a student initiative several years ago. PSU students, notoriously underinsured and under-resourced group, asked for a number of years for dental services to be added to what we were already providing in terms of health services on campus. In 2002, a group of particularly motivated students surveyed their fellow students and then demonstrated there was really high demand on campus for this, and even to the point they were willing to raise an additional student fee to cover the cost. At that time, students worked with PSU and actually with Lamet Dental to get an initial plan started, and after about 2 years, our student health services created a clinic on campus for really the best delivery on campus possible. Demand for the service was immediately high. In 2006, we actually doubled our capacity, and currently the clinic sees about 20,000 student visits per academic year. It's open 6 days a week, every week of the year. It's not closed during spring break or Christmas break or any other time. It's continually operating. In 2008, the Board of Dentistry became aware that we were operating the clinic not in accordance with the law. We had been operating it under the assumption that the health center exemption that we have qualified us. They corrected us. Fortunately, they've been willing to work with us to keep the doors open so as to not deny that care until we could get a statutory fix. We're very thankful for that. What Senate Bill 117 seeks to do is amend ORS 679020 so that we can continue to offer the basic care. As you can see in the bill, there are numerous exemptions to the dental Practices Act already. We feel that universities should have the same ability to operate, state universities should have the same ability to operate dental clinics that the smallest municipality in Oregon currently has. We've had several conversations with dental stakeholders along the way. Unfortunately, they started a little bit late, and how we could actually operate a dental clinic without seeking a statutory fix. And unfortunately, we weren't able to find any model that worked for a public sector employer. So our certified smart people have determined, yes, we really do actually need this statutory fix if we're going to continue to offer this care. Without Senate Bill 117, up to 3,000 students each year are going to lose their basic dental care. So we hope you'll ultimately support Senate Bill 117.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. Bratz?
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. For the record, I'm Patrick Brodsey, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. I think what Jesse alluded to or what he stated is pretty much the facts of the situation. We had found out about this in about 2008 and found out that they weren't in compliance with the law, so we sat down and said, you know, how can we fix this, because we don't want to displace 20,000 dental visits in a year, obviously, for the students. And so obviously the board has withheld any kind of disciplinary action in this time period. We looked at a lot of different laws, and we said the easiest way to do this is just do a minor exemption to the law, and that's what actually Senate Bill 117A is. We are aware of the other issues. When I first came here in 2003, actually the Board of Dentistry had supported a minority ownership of dental clinics, which was defeated by the legislature, and so I don't know what the board's exact position is at this time, but I think what we don't want to do is, this bill had a purpose. I mean, I'm the kind of a person, when someone comes to me and says, I've got a problem, I want to fix it, and I look for the fix. And this is a good fix. I think it'll work very well, and it'll allow the Portland State as well as the other OUS places to operate dental clinics. And then I think the bigger picture, as Representative Maurer and as Senator Mona Sanderson said, needs to be looked at with the stakeholders sitting down at a table and saying, okay, how can we bring this into in compliance? There are some other states that do restrict ownership. It's not just a blanket for the state of Oregon. They have different ways, and we may want to look at some of their ways. So I would encourage the committee to hopefully pass this bill as to not prevent it from becoming law, because I don't maybe you don't know this, but Jesse knows this, but Portland State is soon to become a neighbor of the Board of Dentistry in the actual building. Actually, our board wall, if I knock on this side, I'll actually get Chip Lasby, who's their legal counsel. He'll be right across there, and I just don't want to have any problem with a neighbor.
Maybe so. You guys could run the clinic for it.
No, I don't think I want to do that.
You got a bunch of dentists.
Well, yeah, I know, but anyway, so we encourage you to support this, and then obviously to look in the interim to look at a bigger fix when everybody can sit down and talk about it. And so we thank you, and answer any questions if you have any.
Yes, sir.
Under what authority did the board not take action if they knew a year ago?
Well, because of the fact that Portland State came to us, as well as Oregon University, and talked about how this happened. It wasn't intentional. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't, it was basically an oversight. They thought they were under the current medical laws that exist. And so the board does have the power within the statutes. They have to investigate all complaints filed against them, but they don't have to discipline. And actually, this wasn't a complaint. What had happened is, we were reviewing a complaint, and we said to the, what we do in our complaint process is if someone has seen a dentist and now seen subsequent dentists, we want to get all the records. And so we said, can we get records from your subsequent treating dentist? And they said, oh, yeah, I'll do that, but I have to call Portland State. That's where they're at. And we said, no, Portland State doesn't have a dental clinic. And we went on the website and said, oh, yes, they do. And so they were very cooperative, and we've had no complaints about any of the dentists at their clinic in the tenure that they've been in operation. So based on that information, the board did not seek to go forth any disciplinary action, because they were willing to sit down and say, let's get the law fixed, and then once the law is fixed, we can look at things at that time.
But if that was the Mitch Greenlake Dental Clinic and Storm Door Company, then it might have had a different outcome.
It might have had a different outcome, but again, we'd have to investigate. We'd have to open the complaint. By law, we have to do that, but actually discipline is in the purview of the board.
But the Mitch Greenlake Storm Door and Brain Surgery Clinic would be okay. You can perform brain surgery.
Well, as you all know,
if I was a psychologist,
well,
right?
Chair Greenlake, and committee, as some of you may have recently seen on television,
do some anti-smoking comments.
We do have someone in the state who was recently practicing medicine, who didn't have a license, and prior to that time was practicing both medicine and dentistry in the Portland area. Now he's sort of moved south down to the Bend area. And one of the things that Representative Greenlake's amendment brings to light here is the fact that if you operate medicine in this state without a license, it's considered a felony. But if you operate dentistry in this state without a license, it's only considered a misdemeanor. And I have to tell you, but those men and women that have those little pointy things can do just as much damage.
Practicing medicine and practicing dentistry is not the same as owning a medical clinic.
No, I understand that. Yeah, I understand that. No, there's no question about that.
Is owning a medical clinic without an MD license a felony?
No.
Just checking it.
No, it's not.
I want to be careful with my storm door.
No.
No, I don't wear an orange jumpsuit.
Mr. Petruzzelli, would you like to chime in on this one?
Oh, sure. You know, I'll just get a chance to talk. Thank you. I'm Steve Petruzzelli with Willamette Dental Group. I want to thank Chair Greenlake and Vice Chair Maurer and the rest of the committee for an opportunity to appear before you. today. And as the representative from Portland State was saying, we actually had the program with the students prior to them forming their own, and we viewed it as a transitionary program at that time. I figured some good MBA students up there would start to do some pencil work and everything, and that's probably maybe what happened. And being an alumni of Portland State, I never want to stand in the way of them having an opportunity to move forward. Yeah, you know, we were part of the Dental Practices Act debate that stakeholders came together on about 6 or 7 years ago now, this being the one contentious issue. And it was decided at that point after some debate, even down at the legislature, that the dental ownership by dentists was the preferred way, even discounting minority ownership. And while that may be a good decision or a bad decision, I think potentially dentistry has learned a lot over the last 6 or 7 years and certainly are making, hopefully, what I like to think, much better efforts of working together and being able to come to the legislature with legislation that is supported by unanimously almost all of dentistry. I think the best example of that is probably right now the mid-level provider concept that's coming forward, where I think the decision was to move ahead with the educational aspect but come back in the interim with hopefully a decision that all of dentistry can support as to advance the mid-level provider concept. And I'd like to see that same process move forward with this situation. I certainly think that to allow Portland State, University of Oregon, and whomever else may be involved at the university level to proceed without continuing to be in violation, we certainly would support 1117 and let them go ahead and operate on that basis. And at the same time, hopefully we can come back collectively with all of dentistry and present something in the interim basis in February, if that's when the legislature is going to meet again, that would bring the Dental Practices Act in more compliance in the area of ownership with the realities of the marketplace now. The one thing we wouldn't like to see is what is exactly happening now, where we continue to have a Dental Practices Act, but the exceptions keep growing and growing and growing on a one-at-a-time basis and everything. So I do think it's time to take a look at it again, but I'd like to give all of dentistry a chance to come back with something.
Do you operate some or all of your clinics under one of these exemptions, Mr.
No, we basically have operated. We separate our practice into two aspects, actually three. There's the dental management company that operates everything involved with our practices and provides management to our insurance companies, which is just another separate entity, other than what happens inside the dental operatory. That is handled by the dental practice. And the dental practice not only employs the dentist, but it also employs the hygienist and the assistants also and the denturist. Anybody that has to do with the actual practice and treating of patients is under the dental practice and is supervised by managing dentists within the locations.
Is that a group practice of dentists or a...
That's correct, right. It's Willamette Dental Group, I believe, PC, or Eugene Security's doing business at with Willamette Dental Group in Oregon. And then we have dental practices in Idaho and Washington also, separate from the management companies.
Great. Thank you. Are there other questions?
I have one.
Yes.
This sounds great that we provide this care or that the students have access to this care on the clinic. And I was pretty surprised to find out that there hadn't been one before. It's great. Does it cost the state anything currently? I mean, students have raised their fees in order to support it, I believe I heard.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Harker, this our dental clinic is wholly funded by student fees and fee-for-service. So
entirely.
No, entirely.
That's great.
So no general fund appropriation for this.
Okay. Otherwise, I was afraid that we were going to have to cut it. Today, earlier today, we found out that unlike other states where I have lived, where the school, it's obligatory to put kids in school at the age of 5, here, we don't have to put them in until they're 7. And I realized that we could probably save a fair amount of money if we just increase that age to, say, 10 or 12. So I'm working on it.
For
a while.
Back it off the other.
For a while.
Yeah, back it off the other end. Right, they go from the age of 7 to 11.
You could reduce your dropout rate if you lower the age.
Yeah.
you have anything else to profound to add to this conversation?
No,
okay.
That's where I am right now. I'm working on it, though.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Chris Hoffman, would you come and talk to us, please? We already have, even though we are not in a work session, we have an amendment that has been proposed, and it's already been discussed, and I thought it might make sense if you would just come and give us a little insight on this one.
Yeah, thank you very much. Chair Greenlake,
who's that guy you brought with you, though?
Well, you know, you've seen him around. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, A, thank you very much for allowing me to testify before you today on the proposed amendment. But first wanted to backtrack and talk about Senate Bill 117 and just reinforce what my colleagues were up here today to. All of us got together at the beginning of session, and Margie Hoffman and I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and I should know better. I'm sorry.
I missed it twice this
week. So it has been a very good process putting together Senate Bill 117 and working together to get that through the building. And I just want to emphasize that one of the amendments before you today would repeal the part of statute that says that only dentists can own a dental clinic. And it is a hugely contentious issue within the dental community, and even our membership at the Oregon Dental Association tends to be split on this. It is something that we would like the opportunity to work with the other dental stakeholders and those organizations over the interim and come back to the committee with hopefully what we always strive for, consensus. But I'm happy to answer any questions that people have.
Are there any questions? Good.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Alan Trussiter, and I represent the Oregon Dental Association. I want to first say thank you to Representative Maurer for, A, letting us know that he had an amendment, and, B, that he was willing to hold off on offering that amendment until we had a time for a full and complete discussion on this issue. It is an issue that is of great importance to dentists. We believe it serves a purpose, but that belief is not unanimously held among the dental profession. And so we have to get our dentists together, get others together in the that practice in the field of dentistry, and see if we can come to you with some ideas on this. There are other states that restrict this in various ways. It is not correct to say that Oregon is the only state like this, but there are differences, and we'd like the opportunity to explore all those and bring them to your interim committee or the appropriate interim committee and talk about this as we get ready for the 2011 session.
Great. My assumption is that Senator Montes Anderson will have priority on this, and we'll ask Representative Maurer to represent us in that discussion. Something you wanted to add to that?
Do I get to pick some people too, Mr. Chair?
You can take that up to Senator Montes Anderson.
Well, there are other professions. Mr. Trussiter identified several professions in this state that have ownership limitations.
Yes.
One was attorneys.
Yes.
Which I knew about. CPAs.
I'm pretty sure CPAs
and,
are
and
still
And I verified
way.
That.
Yeah.
And so that's...
And I'm certain about the practice of law, that you can't own a law practice without being a member of the bar.
How about funeral directors?
That I don't know. But
I suspect it is.
It might be.
Well, funeral directors.
I
believe that is true. It used to be the law.
I think so. Sketchy
lobbying career I had.
There is no health profession that has an ownership requirement in the state of Oregon. What?
No, she's talking to me.
Oh, okay. I brought this up, a profession is a profession.
I mean, I would believe that a profession licensed by the state of Oregon, that there is no difference between being a lawyer and being a dentist and being a doctor. They're all licensed professions that you give the imprimatur to go forth and do your practice. So you're looking, I understand that you're looking for, are there any other health professionals that require ownership, and I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that there are other equally learned professions that do require that the owner of the practice be a licensed professional.
Yeah, I suppose that it will be an interesting discussion, is what does it mean to own a practice? I mean, I suspect yep. that's...
We can. The law does allow us, and the Attorney General has opined, that we may hire administrators and practice management people to help on the business side of the business. But when it comes to patient care, we believe, dentists believe, and the law supports that, that dental care ought to be managed by dentists.
But I can hire a lawyer to come and work for me. I can be Corporation X, and I can have my corporate counsel.
Yes.
My assumption is that lawyer can practice law while he's employed by me.
Yes. If he's a member of the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Assuming he's a member of the bar. And I think I could hire a physician to come and work for me doing physician things. And the question is, could I hire a dentist to come and work for me? I mean, I think there's a difference between doing dental practice and owning a dental clinic, okay. I think. But I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a matter of curiosity.
I believe if you are not a licensed dentist in Oregon, you cannot own a dental practice.
Can I hire a dentist to come and work for me?
Not the dental practice portion, no. You could have, like Mr. Petroselli just described in Willamette Dental, where they have various branches. There are non-dentists that do the practice management portion. There are non-dentists that do the administrative records portion. But the portion of that corporation that provides dental care is run by a dentist, which I think is entirely appropriate.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, also, they own the patient records and the information, so they don't have somebody telling them you have to work with patient, you have to turn out this number of people, or you have to, you know, provide this kind of care. So it allows the dentist to own and keep the retain the information about their patients and their patient records, and also they get to make the healthcare decisions about their clientele base.
I'm Corporate X, and I hire a lawyer, and that lawyer is doing work for me. That lawyer might be to consult with my employees with their problems or anything else. If I'm the corporation, I assume I own those records of that lawyer in that case.
Okay, presumably that lawyer is not dealing with health records.
No, I'm talking about dealing with legal records, dealing
yeah.
with their practice issues.
Mm-hmm.
If I hire a doctor to come and examine health insurance.
Well, wait, excuse me. Back up just a second.
Yeah, the lawyer.
If you own a corporation
right.
and you have a corporate lawyer,
yep.
that corporate lawyer doesn't have individual clients. That corporate lawyer serves one client, the Greenlick Corporation.
He's an individual under the law.
He's not seeing individual clients and keeping individual records. That lawyer is seeing clients of the Greenlick whatever, LLP. So in the dental practice, though, we are seeing patients that each have individual dental records, and we maintain those confidentially and in control of the dentist.
Okay, well, this should be
and this is
an
just
interesting
the
discussion.
The discussion
yes,
we'll have.
That's exactly. Let's not carry it out here. Thank you very much
thank
for coming
you.
Forward, and thank you for offering to help on this in the interim. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 132. And Madam Administrator, will you talk to us about this, please?
Yes, this is a housekeeping bill. What happened is, what they're trying to cure with this bill is that the maximum civil penalty that the Board of Naturopathic Examiners can impose was increased to $5,000 in ORS 685.900, but the penalty was left unchanged in ORS 685.110. And so the goal is to make those two statutes consistent and allow the Board of Naturopathic Examiners to impose a $5,000 fine.
Is the Board of Naturopathic Examiners a semi-independent board?
That I don't know.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Ann Walsh, the Executive Director of the Naturopathic Board. I'm sorry I didn't get here in time. Traffic just kept
here
me.
You are. You're in time,
I'm here.
Obviously.
I'm here now. Naturopathic Board is not a semi-independent board. We are another funds agency, and our funding comes from our licensee base.
You have anything else to add to the discussion on this bill?
I don't really. I didn't know if there would be questions, and so I felt I should be here in case there were questions.
Are there questions?
And if I can add one more thing. You have in your materials in front of you some materials that Ms. Walsh sent
us. I actually also brought copies.
Okay. So you may have one or you may have two, but you do have some material.
So this is about consistency in one part of the law and another, as opposed to, quote, raising the fine level.
Correct.
Okay. Which I think we talked
about. That last session, didn't we?
Yeah. When was it raised to the other?
In 2005.
It's been a while.
Wow.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 132. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 159. Madam Administrator?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Take your time. We don't have 40 bills today.
It's a nice change.
It's different, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. What this measure does is it authorizes certain public officials to inspect and obtain information pertinent to the investigation of communicable disease and protects the confidentiality of information obtained during the investigation. It clarifies the authority of the Department of Human Services and the local public health administrator to investigate reportable diseases. It specifies a standard for release of information relating to clear and convincing evidence that the disclosure is necessary, and it changes the wording of the local public health authority to public health administrator.
The local public health authority?
That's what it says.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Hi.
Talk to us.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the communicable disease program for the public health division within the Department of Human Services.
Why are you wasting your time here today?
Flu. We've been all swine flu all the time for the past week and a half. You have my testimony. Let me just make a few comments about the bill real quickly. I think in general we have the authority we need to control communicable diseases, but this bill is meant to address a few ambiguities and minor deficiencies, relatively minor deficiencies. So the way I see it doing three things. Number one is when we start to investigate a case of reportable disease, sometimes we need to collect information around the case. That may include, for example, interviews of well persons. If we do, for example, a case control study to compare the well people to the sick people. And if the outbreak were, say, in a hospital and we needed to get the names of well persons around the case, the objection would arise, well, these people don't have a case of reportable disease, and the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act prevents us from releasing any information other than reportable diseases. So I think in most circumstances, hospitals want to be able to work with us, but they feel inhibited by the federal statute. By making this explicitly part of our state public health authority, there's an exemption within the federal statute that defers to state public health authority. So that's point number one. Point number two is it allows us to protect information. Right now, our statute protects the information on the reportable disease cases, but not on others around them. So if I went and called a bunch of people randomly to say, did you eat the peanut butter, and collected a bunch of information from them, theoretically that's all releasable under the Public Records Act because our current law protects cases but not controls and other things. So this would protect that ancillary information from Public Records Act requests. And then finally, we're tightly constrained, I think appropriately so in most cases, around what information we can release. But things come up where we do want to release information other than the two circumstances that are currently in statute. For example, if we have a case of tuberculosis, who hospital calls us up, says we just released this guy, lab test came back 2 days later, he has tuberculosis. And we know that this guy is in and out of homeless shelters. Currently, we don't know that we have the authority to release the name of the guy to a homeless shelter and say, be on the lookout for Joe. He might have tuberculosis, and we want you to call us right away. And in fact, when we presented this to the Senate committee, Chair Moniz Anderson, who had been a public health administrator, said, oh, yeah, I had to break that law when I was a public health administrator. So the purpose of this is to clarify that in certain circumstances.
Did she say that on the record?
Blah, 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 blah.
But So that's the purpose of the bill, and I'd be happy to take
questions. Citizens arrest. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The timing of this is perfect, given the swine flu issue. Help me understand, given this current issue and how you manage this, how you personally and how the department manages this, how this is without this, it's inhibiting your current ability to manage. And I guess we're not managing the disease; we're just trying to understand it at this point. But it would be great to have some real world examples right now about how you're inhibited by not having this.
Mm-hmm. Representative Greenlick, or Chairman Greenlick, and Representative Bruin. For example, if we heard about a bunch of cases of swine flu in a hospital, we would want to collect a bunch of information about everybody on that floor, whether they were a case of reported illness or not. We want to know who gets the disease and who doesn't get the disease, so we can tell, well, what's the difference? What are the sick people doing that the well people aren't doing? What is their risk factor that makes them more likely to get sick?
At Western University, for example.
Right. At Western Oregon University, we had a case. He was apparently going to classes all over the place, and we want to know who some of those people are. We want to know how intense is the exposure required to contract the illness from this case. So there's a bunch of information that gets collected routinely, and when you're dealing with healthcare, they're nervous about giving you names of anybody else because of HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and also we don't know that we can protect the names of those people that we interviewed if they don't turn out to have the illness, because our statute only allows us to protect the reported cases.
Paul, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about this health authority thing. As I remember looking at the structure of the public health division, group, whatever it used to be called, there was nothing in statute that defined a state health authority. There were local health authority. The local health authority was defined in statute as being the county commission or the county judge, depending on the form of county government. Will this change that? I see you deleting something about health authority and talking about a health administrator, which in current statute is not the health authority. Is that right?
Oh, boy. Representative Greenlick, thanks. I'm not sure I know the answer to the question. It was a legal thing that our Assistant Attorney General worked out with the Conference of Local Health Officials to try to make clear that the local public health administrator or her designee, which is often a health officer, could take action. But I don't understand the legalities behind it all.
I'd really like, could you get your Assistant Attorney in to talk to us about that, because it seemed rather important that the county commissioners were identified as the local health authority. Then they delegated to an administrator or to some other people, but it laid the responsibility for health in the county where it needed to be, in the county decision-making group. And I wonder, do we have a statute now that defines a state health authority? Did we slip that in somewhere? Was that part of Susan's reforms in the last...
Right, as part of Dr. Susan Allen's omnibus bill. Well, actually, let me backtrack a little bit. It used to be the Public Health Division, and then when we had a reformation of the Department of Human Services, almost all of the language just reads the department. And then I think in Susan Allen's bill, it became the Public Health Director.
Became the health authority, or the
yes.
department became the health authority?
I think the public health director became the health authority. Because there's information that you don't necessarily want to get out to the rest of the department. You want it to reside within the sort of world of public health, if
with
you will.
With the health officer?
Right.
You don't have a gun in the badge like Mel does? Is that
right? I get no gun.
No gun?
Chairman Greenlee.
I don't know how.
It's good. It keeps me safe.
Yeah. Other questions? Could we, before we move on this, I'd like to know what we're doing that changes the notion of either local health authority or state health authority, and it would be useful to know the difference. I mean, I think we need an authority and an administrator. I think both of those are important. So.
Okay, I'll really have to talk to our Assistant Attorney General about
maybe
that.
Maybe she could send, he or she?
She.
She could send us a memo on it. That would be useful, or come and talk to us next time.
Will do.
Well, thank you very much. Does anybody else want to testify on House Bill 159? Paul, thank you for coming. Get back out there and stop that flu. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 159. Do we have any other business before us? We are adjourned.
I have a question.